Welcome to Girl, Get a Real Job, a podcast series by Women of the Wick, a platform amplifying the visibility, voices and work of women, trans and non-binary creatives. I'm your host, Sara Karpanen, a multimedia artist, writer and the founder of Women of the Wick. Girl, Get a Real Job is a space where we normalize money and business talk as artists and creative practitioners. To continue the conversation, please find us on social media at Women of the Wick and Girl Get a Real Job. Now, let's start talking about the real worth of our creative work.
Thank you so, so, so much for all of you for joining us tonight for the Female Founded Celebrating Sustainable Leaders panel discussion. My name is Sara Karpanen and I'm the founder of Women of the Wick, a feminist platform democratizing media spaces, and we run workshops, panel discussions such as this one, and also we published our biannual magazine Wowzine in November and working towards the second issue that is going to get launched in June. If you are interested in hearing more about the storytelling program that is free for everyone, do kind of visit our Wowzine station in the corner where you can also grab your copy of the last issue that is built around the theme of belonging. But tonight we are focusing on International Women's Week, and I want to give my heartfelt thanks to the Trampery for organizing this beautiful event together with us. It is incredibly important for us, obviously, to come together and celebrate the incredible achievements that all of you are individually doing in your practices as well in your personal life. Now, there are also a lot of things still to tackle in terms of gender equality and to reach that point where women are earning the same as men and also are seen in the top leadership positions. So that's why we are here today, and also without further ado, I would like to introduce yourself to our wonderful group of panelists tonight. So Jenia Minerva next to me is the founder of Bing London, named one of the most innovative fashion companies in the world. So as a sustainable accessories brand, Bing London is on a mission to change the way we view waste. Jenia is also one of the residents here at the Trampery, and yes, if you want to ask anything in terms of being a resident at the Trampery, she's your go-to person. Lydia Bolton is a slow fashion designer and sustainability creator whose designs are created using entirely dead stock and unwanted textiles. Lydia founded her namesake brand Lydia Bolton in 2019, feeling a responsibility to show how fashion could be enjoyed in a way that didn't harm the environment. Piave Vecchi is one of our Wowzine contributors and writers, also the previous storytelling program graduate, and an advocate for reducing textile waste in the fashion industry. She's also the co-founder of Colecci, a fashion collective and agency. Then we have Raisha Audren, also my next door neighbor in the studio, a textile designer and founder of Weapon, a 3D clothing production company. Chantal Amenuevo, last but not least, is a social entrepreneur and the founder of Rias London. And I got to know about Chantal's wonderful practice and journey throughout the Young Entrepreneurs Alliance program. She's also the winner of last year's YAP program. So big applause, first of all, for a wonderful panel.
Industry. Oh, very light. Very light. Microphone.
Is it on? Whoa, nice question. I actually always say that the biggest challenge is the fact that most fashion companies, and I'm not talking about all that's here, but the majority of fashion companies are primarily driven by profits. I mean, it's more of a capitalism versus other forms of existence, I think, question. But I think the guys that we are up against, you know, the H&Ms, the Zaras of this world, I always say that it's a system built on profit first. And sorry, this is not very light at all.
It's going to get lighter. Can you also speak to the mic? This is going to
be I will get lighter. But I think the issue there is profit first. I know it's a difficult paradigm to shift, but it feels like there are enough people in this room, but also in the industry in general now, that are actually making that shift. And it's a tricky one. I would say this thinking of profits first, because it trickles down from the CEO, from the founders of every company. It trickles down to the people they hire, the targets they set, the entire paradigm, and everyone is motivated by profits. I think this needs to shift, and this is what we're trying to shift by putting impact first. You go to I'll be very quick, you go to a fashion like that, I don't know, an industry conference, and everyone's talking about metrics, and all those metrics are about customer conversion, about the user journey, how well the people convert, like how many clicks people make on the ad that you put. And I always come in and challenge those things by saying, can we merge those metrics with the impact that those people are making and the impact that the company is making? Is there a way of actually seeing it in a more, I hate the word holistic, but in a more holistic way? I think this is the biggest industry, it's like actually shifting that focus from profit to impact. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think it's possible, maybe.
Is there a possibility to kind of view the agenda or the challenge as well, that purpose plus profit could equal impact?
I think it's, yeah, and there's a gender element to this, but it's a longer conversation, and I really want to pass on the microphone.
Lydia, would you like to give your two cents in the question?
About the biggest issues in the industry?
Yeah, what you've recognised that you have perhaps faced or...
Yeah, I think the big issues are people, we think quite immediately, so we don't necessarily think about the wider impact of kind of like our purchasing, so that's like consumers as well as brands. So we don't think about who else is really affected in like the whole chain of what we produce and also what we consume. So I think like part of like sustainability is really thinking about everyone's impacted, like the planet, the people, all the other communities down the line, as well as us just like from designers and makers and brand point of view wanting to produce something great and like from a brand's point of view, like make money and profit, but then from a consumer's point of view of wanting to buy something nice, but actually still not thinking about down the line who's affected by it, who's impacted by it. So yeah, I think thinking about, yeah, the wider sphere of what happens when we purchase things and produce things as makers and brand owners.
Fantastic. All of you are sustainable fashion leaders, founders. I would like to ask you as well, Lydia, I know that you're an advocate of sustainability. I've seen many of your reels on Instagram, shaming Shane and the likes. But what does sustainability mean to you?
For me, sustainability, it's two-part. It's thinking about, like I just said, like everyone involved, the, like who else is involved in all the decisions that you make, the planet, how is the planet affected by like waste that we produce, and also how other communities across the world, because it's normally like the global south and those like not in the west that are really affected by the decisions that people in the west make. So kind of who else in the world is affected by it, So sustainability for me is thinking about everyone in the chain that is going to be impacted, and also working in a way that coexists with everyone in the world, but in a non-harmful way. So how can I build a brand, create a brand that is coexisting peacefully with people and not causing harm to the planet and to everyone else, and that maintaining for a long time. So that means being considerate about, well, for me, I'm obviously waste conscious, but in the wider scale, sustainability, brands and people being considerate about the waste they produce and everything like that. So it's like thinking of everything in its much larger scale, not just in your insular kind of momentary decisions.
Love it. And Chiara, you've recently done a successful crowdfunding campaign for your journal. Could you tell us a little bit about that, and also in relation to sustainability? I think you have to keep it just very, very close to you.
What was the second part? As in my thoughts on sustainability?
On sustainability in your practices.
So with the journal, so with Kelechi, we kind of do loads of research and insight. And I think a few years ago, one of the things that we were really curious about was fashion and farming and the relationship between agriculture, farming, farm to fibre. We're writing a collaborative book about that process. But going back to, I guess, your question on sustainability, I think we were talking about it earlier in terms of we don't like the word sustainability because it's lost its meaning, but I remember kind of probably more so at the beginning of the whole sustainability movement, actually just going to Google and what sustainability means at its core, and it's literally just using what you have and making use of the things that are around you. And I think that's something that can be applied on a personal level in terms of, okay, I live in a house. If we're talking about fashion and clothes, it could literally be as little as kind of shopping your own wardrobe or borrowing from a friend and stuff like that. But also, it isn't just about clothing, it's also about finances. So we could kind of do kind of loads of work, but if, for example, no one's being paid fairly and no one can actually sustain their living, then that's also not sustainable. So it's really looking at sustainability, I guess that word holistically, but kind of looking at it in different areas of your life as well, and kind of thinking about how we can use things. And I think the other day I was at an event, and I think I kind of said, because I kind of say the same thing, but when people ask me, so what is being sustainable? I'm just like, just use what you have. And she was like, oh yeah, like not, and stopping, and not using anything. And I became a plant mum of COVID. And that has completely changed the way I also view sustainability, because so recently I have like three aloe veras, and they're, I don't know, one's about to die. One's like super healthy, and like one's kind of, you know, a revived it somehow. And I realised that actually to kind of keep it sustaining and to keep it going, I have to cut off the leaves every now and then. And I think there's that thing of there isn't anything wrong in using or taking, but it's about equally giving and taking. And I kind of see that as being sustainable, because at the end of the day, we won't just stop, but it is kind of, I guess the word circular is the buzzword for this, but it's kind of being 360 about it and, yeah, giving as much as you take and vice versa.
I love hearing about you being a plant mom, because you also wrote a piece about allotments and the positive effects of having an allotment space in a city in the recent housing issue. So wonderful to hear that. What about you, Gracia? Thoughts on sustainability?
Yes, I've thought about it a lot. So yeah, this is a great question for me, because I think it's a very hard word that people don't know exactly what it means, because it means everything and nothing at the same time. And it's an extremely overcomplicated systems approach to thinking. But I think ultimately what it's getting down to for me is about rethinking our consumption and production practices. So basically taking a design approach, because that's where I come from. I'm a designer, so I'm going to think of things as a designer. And I think that most of our consumption practices, how we've designed our economic models, how we've designed our production models, were all designed in a time that we no longer live in. That's like the main thing. They were designed 150 years ago, Industrial Revolution, completely different time. And that's just outdated. And so it's thinking about, okay, sustainability really is just how do we completely rethink and redesign consumption and production practices that align with the world that we live in today, at like at a basic level. And then obviously that gets super granular and more complicated as you go along, but that I think is a fundamental thing, is like our waste issue, our climate change issue fundamentally is a design flaw. We can redesign things, we can be circular, we can be regenerative, we can be all these things, but that's fundamentally rethinking, redesigning how we do things.
Thank you, Sons, for sharing. And Chantel, so you are at the cusp of like starting your second social enterprise. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey as well as what does sustainability mean to you and your practice?
So I graduated in fashion design, and kind of just leaving that institutional space and putting yourself into where am I going to go next, who am I going to work for next, I literally could not see myself anywhere. And then educating myself in sustainability, realizing this is the need, like we need to start designing for the future, we need to think and we need to be more innovative with what we do, especially in a design point of view, because I feel we don't have the responsibility, but we actually have the power to change and shift what goes out into the world, whether you be in fashion or product design or anything. There's just something about the choices in material, the choices in how it's being made and everything. So I actually will piggyback on what everyone else is saying. Firstly, yeah, I think people and the planet is like so key with sustainability. I can't design without thinking about the people who actually look like me at the beginning of the supply chain and at the end of the supply chain. I feel like my why with being part of the sustainable movement, or let's stop saying sustainability, but more so like the climate justice movement, is just to be able to be part of the change to like help, well for me is to help my country in the Philippines, being one of the first countries to be affected by climate change. So that was my why, and so whenever I design, whenever I think about how I can put my impact, my footprint into this world, and as a designer, how can I make that shift with the fashion industry. And so with my two businesses, it's just about like bringing in community, bringing in social impact, and how we can work together for a better future, rather than just being like, oh, just the designers or the consumers or anything. No, we're working together. We're working together for a result to like help each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just, she's not the only one thinking about that. 80% of the environmental footprint of a product is decided at the design stage. So it really is all about design. Like at the beginning of where you are in producing the thing, we have the power to shift an entire value chain into a direction. So
can I add something on this? We measured the CO2 emissions of our products from the waste source all the way to which mode of transport is used to deliver it to the material manufacturer, from the material manufacturer, their electricity supplier, how much energy is being used per square meter of each particular material, and we're talking about several countries manufacturing, turning discarded uniforms into felt, discarded leather offcuts into leather. So we spent 6 months of lockdown, we wanted to make sure that, I mean, we kind of in theory, we knew from literature that we were doing the right thing. We were like, can we please check?
That's great.
So knowing the number, we were like, okay, let's check, are we making the right decisions? And we traced the entire supply chain and measured CO2 emissions of everything, to the point that the product, we make handbags, is leaving our studio. And the difference was 87%.
That's crazy.
So what we compared it to, we made a few assumptions, but we compared it to a high street equivalent made from, so we only use recycled or upcycled materials to make our products. We compared it to virgin materials handbag of exactly the same design, so this but made from virgin polyester, and made in the Global South. We actually assumed, because the majority of products like ours are made in China. We assume the materials are virgin, that it's made in China and it's then flown to the UK. This is what normally happens. Versus recycled materials, waste as the source, manufactured here in Stratford. We make everything in Stratford and compared the numbers, and it's an 87%, so it's even higher than 80%.
Yeah.
It can be achieved by just actually going back to this, prioritising impact versus prioritising profit.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got very geeky on this.
That's good, let's go geeky. Anything you wanted to add, Lydia?
That's why I quit my job back in 2019, because I worked as a design assistant at a fashion brand and I loved it. I loved my job. It was like a contemporary fashion brand, so it wasn't like fast fashion or anything. But then I just realised as a designer I had responsibility and ability. So not even just responsibility, that I actually could like create products that were more better for the planet. So yeah, then when you said that about being 80% in the design stage, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. That's literally why I quit my job.
Yeah. It makes it feel good too. It's like, oh, as a designer, you have the power to change the world, you know? But it's an empowering thing where you're like, okay, I can actually make choices in a certain way that affects real change, which is quite empowering, really.
Empowering. I like that word. Today's panel discussion is titled Female Founders. And yesterday we obviously celebrated International Women's Day. However, I also just read The Guardian, and that was reported in various other news platforms as well, that we are still 300 years away from gender equality, stated by the UN Secretary General. So there is still some work to be done, right? We can all acknowledge that. Hopefully it doesn't take us 300 years. Now, you panelists, what kind of challenges have you experienced as the female founder? Now, obviously, if you haven't, I also would love to hear of your thoughts. Who would like to go first? Okay, I'm going to choose that. Piave, please.
Challenges. I feel like it's interesting. There's so many kind of different things that goes into, I guess, the whole being a female founder, but there are some kind of interesting behavioural differences that I think studies have picked up, and a lot of them are related to things like confidence and feeling confidence and the way that girls are brought up versus boys being brought up and stuff like that. And I think that there is an impact on that as well. And I mean, I'm a mum as well, and very conscious of, I guess, I think there was, I was speaking to like another mum, and I think she grew up in New Zealand, and she was saying, I did sports throughout my whole teens, and when I come here and I'm raising my children, none of them want to do sports as teens because they're too scared, whereas the boys are just, you know, And I think there's like, I don't really know if this answers the question, but I think there's some interesting subtle differences in the way that as females were taught to be confident or were taught to go for it. There's obviously a lot on childcare as well and how unequal that world is on its own. So I feel like I've been quite lucky enough to have a support system to then be able to do kind of some of the stuff that I want to do. But I've seen other women whose careers have, and as much as, you know, the news are constantly talking about mompreneurs and but the reality of it is it's not that easy. And there are women that are in, you know, jobs that have had kind of significant life changes just because they've had children and things like that. And I think things like childcare and that kind of system, for me anyway, is something that I feel that when that changes, or the perception of who looks after the children changes, that will make a huge difference. And to be honest, I think whether you have children or not, I think this whole kind of climate, as you mentioned, you called it climate justice. I think this whole thing of wanting to save the future or save the world, which kind of feels like the space that we're in terms of saving the planet, doing all these good things. A lot of the time you kind of think it is for that next generation, and sometimes it is so that, you know, we don't want anything to happen to us as well as individuals, but we also do want the world to continue, and we don't want to kind of constantly witness odd weathers or, you know, floods. And again, being from so my family's from Congo, and so for us, like, we're kind of heavily in terms of the minerals that we have and the way that, I guess, we kind of, as in terms of our land, we provide quite a lot in terms of minerals, the coltan, or the stuff that produces a lot of the tech that we have, without actually seeing anything being given back. So it's like a huge, kind of a huge thing, and I often find that the sustainability movement is pioneered by women. Like, every time I'm at a talk, I'm like, wow, this is such a woman-dominated space. And I mean, yeah, they say we're nurturers by nature, and I don't know anymore. I'm just like, you are who you are, regardless. But I think it's, I think the sustainability space is quite special, because I do notice there's kind of more women in there. It seems to be a fight that we're constantly fighting for, and a fight that a lot of women have done for free as well. I saw a post the other day that said, because we randomly run a knitting club, don't ask. But there was a post that came up. There was one post from the Business of Fashion that basically said, why knitwear is the next best thing? And I think it's probably because of Bella Hadid, because they got like a knitwear brand she's taken over. I don't know, Kim Kardashian did an advert with like people knitting. I don't know. But then within that, there's the... But then within...
off all of a sudden. Is it still on? Your mic?
No,
yours is on.
Okay. But then at the same time, there was another article that I saw, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was about how women's work is constantly undervalued. So just because it's knitting, and actually I was looking up what jobs could you have with knitting, and I was speaking to someone that's a LCF lecturer in knitwear, and he was talking about, yeah, there's like a lot of technical jobs, and there's loads of jobs within the knitwear industry. And kind of, and even with the fashion and farming stuff that we're doing, one thing that we're unlocking or discovering is that there's a lot of kind of industries that have sadly disappeared because of the fact that the UK majorly outsources all, like, most of our kind of clothing production. But then there's a movement of people that are actually lobbying the government and saying, look, we need our machinery back, we need to bring back linen, because our land grows this fabric, or this crop, and we can create fabrics out there and things like that. And I think that there's this, there's kind of this movement towards doing kind of all of this stuff, and it's a lot of it, I mean, yeah, there are men involved, but a lot of it is kind of seeing work that appears to be woman's work as not valuable for whatever reason. So whether it's sewing or being a seamstress, or I think I was telling someone just today, I met someone that she proudly called herself a mender, and I'm just like, why not? Why can't we just value some of these jobs as jobs, because it's a skill that somebody has that they can do? Whereas we'll value something like tech. Fair enough, though I'm not quite happy with the way that they mine for the tech, but the tech, for example, in a very male-dominated industry, have such a high value to them, but a lot of kind of things that are perceived to be quite female, even though I know male tailors and men that can sew and stuff like that, but I think there's a way that we view kind of industry and things like that. Yeah, tailor. They're the same thing in my eyes. I think, yeah, only difference, one might be in Savile Row and whatever, but I think, yeah, there's definitely something that we kind of, like I said, like two things at once, but there's definitely something that needs to be done in the way that we see what we perceive as women's work, whether that's knitting, sewing, or, I don't know, being kind to the planet, having some value on that, and people paying for that as well as a service, because they...
Yeah. I was just going to add that what you're saying about women being mostly in like environmental justice, and when you go to these events, it's a lot of women on the panel. The research basically backs that up, and they have this like whole thing. I kind of find it tricky to talk about like women and men, you know, and having that be so like binary. But instead, it's more like traits that a large majority of women have versus traits that a large majority of another whatever might have. But the traits that a majority of women have are basically the ability to think in a collaborative, collective, holistic way. And I think that's what we need to focus more on. It's like, what are the specific traits that we see in a majority of a subset of people, and how can we teach that to, you know, the next generation, gender aside, you know? And so, yeah, we are seeing a lot of women in environmental justice or climate action. Why is that? And that's where the research is basically backed up. Collectivism, collaboration, finding peace, solving issues, and things like that.
Yeah, go ahead, Sandra.
This conversation actually got me thinking, because
we predominantly see women in the fashion industry, in the climate justice movements and everything. Well, specifically in the fashion industry, we see women as seamstresses and like in the jobs and everything, but the CEOs are mostly men. And we think of fashion as like such a feminine industry, but like it's still controlled by men. There's like, well, the H&M CEO is like a billionaire now, right? And it's just crazy because they still have so much control over like women's livelihoods, and they just, I don't know, it's just like a really confusing like fact to me, I think. Mm. Yeah.
And even in terms of entrepreneurship, let me just get this back up again.
Is there a... Okay, it's working.
Just fell asleep.
Like 1 in 3 entrepreneurs is female in the UK, a staggering number, as well as, yes, as you said, Chantel, women just don't then end up in those leadership positions. Why do you think is that?
I want to add my own personal experience.
Yes, please go ahead.
I think, firstly, women are just taught not to speak up socially, let's say that, right? So I've been in a situation where I spoke with a man in the industry, and I was trying to get advice from him. One of my mentors like told me, okay, you can get advice from him, he works in the industry, he works with all these brands, etc. As much as he's not in the sustainable industry, I thought I would still get some insight off of him, right? No, he was talking over me, and there was like this feeling I had sitting on that chair that like I just wanted to stand up and leave, but I genuinely could not. I couldn't even speak up for myself, and things like that, and things like talking about money, talking about salaries, I feel like were just like put to the side, pushed down, and spoken over. And I think that's where maybe women feel a bit scared to go into an industry where it's so predominantly male-dominated, right? We can't speak up over them, and we end up getting mansplained over or anything. So I think for me as someone who's starting up, that's been one of my challenges at the moment, trying to get into this, into entrepreneurship and trying to speak up for myself. And I've been watching documentaries like, let's say, I think Dropout, or you get like these female entrepreneurs, CEOs, and they physically change into like men characteristics, the voices, the way they dress up, the way they look, and that shouldn't be the way. We should be completely who we are to basically fight and do what we want to do. Yeah.
Sorry, another research. All of this research. I don't do, I just research. It's a really interesting PhD guy. And I think that this, like what you're talking about, entrepreneurial women, there are not a lot of them. And this goes, I think, to any group that's just a non-majority. They don't feel like they see themselves in that role, right? Because there are certain traits that a CEO has. And so they don't feel like they could, even if they're doing the job, even if they're having all the responsibilities of, say, a CEO, they just don't feel like they could call themselves a CEO because they don't match this a very typical structure, archetype, right? So there was this PhD guy, forgot his name, I know research, but I'm terrible with names. But he basically tried to figure out what that was and put it to essentially the thing that we're seeing with like any type of like POC. You're just not able to see yourself in that role. And so he just outlined the traits of what a CEO would be, and it's like bullish and outspoken. It was all these things that were very individualistic, and people like POC or non-majority people probably rely on their community a lot more than they do than like a majority person, individualistic, you know, CEO archetype. And so it was basically overall summary. In summary, it was explaining that if we wanted to see a more diverse range of CEOs and entrepreneurs, people, we would have to shift what that looks like. You know, so you could be a CEO, but it might not look like a typical CEO. And so it's like finding those spaces that, you know, it's like, you know what, I am actually doing this. It might not be the individualistic thing and archetype that we're used to, but I'm doing just the same amount of stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Did I get
sure.
Can I just add something that hasn't been mentioned today, is access to funding. Sorry, it's an elephant in the room, and I think the latest numbers, I'm not entirely sure, but it used to be 2% of all venture capitalist funding are going to women in the UK. So, and we're talking about scaling impacts, right? It's about, are you going to be the next H&M? Are you going to be the next Zara? Are you going to be the next something bigger than a small startup? And the key there is access to funding. The access to funding, I mean, grants aside, 2%, that's really quite shocking, isn't it? I'm not a very typical founder. I'm in my 40s. I've got children. Yeah. Like,
red flag.
Red flag, exactly. Red flag. And the fact that, you know, when so far we've been very lucky, but it is an issue. There is a program, it's called, I think, Capital Pilot or something, where companies, startups are ranked, it's almost like a blind ranking system. So they don't see who you are, they don't know your gender, and they've just published their numbers, and I think the number of female founded businesses funded through them is something like 37%. I mean, that's a big jump, right? From 2 to 37. Don't quote me on the numbers, I'm just doing it off the top of my head. But it's a big difference. So I think we have to talk about this. if we are to scale the solutions that are spoken about in this room, let's just not forget that we need to change. And that's all linked to who are the men, and I have to say they're men, who are the men in those rooms making those decisions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that goes down to just incentive structures. That goes down
absolutely.
To what are we incentivizing?
What are we incentivizing? Exactly.
Yeah.
But then it's also, information sharing as well, because I think... So, actually, as you were talking as well, as both of you were talking, there's a small group that we started collectively called CIS UK. It's literally just if you've ever been a woman of colour, no matter where you're from, and you've felt like the other in the room within the sustainability space, then it's just a space for you to feel like you're not alone. And it literally just exists as a WhatsApp group. That's all it is. It's like, you know, we go to events together, we support each other, that kind of thing. And one thing that kind of has grown out of not just that group, but other kind of similar groups that are forming of people that feel like they've been othered for whatever reason is that whole information sharing. It's like I can only be, I'm only as kind of big as what I know, like what I don't know, whatever the saying is. But is that whole thing of even with the whole funding world, I think it's only been the past year or 2 years that I've even started to look into it. And actually, we did a CIS talk about it where we invited the founder of Bundley, who's running currently like a successful baby rental platforms in the fashion space. And she was talking about her venture capital journey. And I think it's, and again, in a room of other people and just sharing that information. And I think for centuries, we constantly have things like the boys' clubs and the golf and the, you know, even, I mean, I've worked in the corporate space and you kind of see where the, you know, how the kind of men meet up and also the women that are quite, that I think the word is probably masking or acting more masculine so that you can then be invited into those spaces. So I think it's also this whole thing of how is information being shared. And I constantly follow, there are kind of women like Ashita from Bi-Rotation and Josephine from Sojo that are constantly, you know, putting out articles and kind of being, and there are more women like that and other women venture capitalists as well that are slowly rising. It's still a very tiny number, but it's that whole thing of kind of where are our networks for information sharing and where do you get your information from? Because a lot of it is kind of friends exchanging things with each other and stuff like that. So it's having spaces that actually that allows you to share that information. But I agree, kind of funding is a massive thing because it's make or break.
Thank you. And so what kind of support have you received along your way? Lydia, would you mind starting?
You can use this one. When I started, I didn't think
I had that much support at all. It was very much just me figuring everything out the whole time. So I just listened to a lot of podcasts, and then from podcasts would hear about someone else and then research their podcast, and then they'd reference an audiobook, and then I'd download the audiobook. So I think, like, basically that's how I learned how to do pretty much everything, was just
podcasts.
Basically, yeah. I don't know what I mean, I only found podcasts like 6 months into having my brand, so I don't know why I did for that first 6 months. Probably why it's quite slow. So yeah, literally learn. I feel like the first 2 years of me starting my business was really just me on my own, trying to learn everything. And like now when I chat to people that are starting a brand, I kind of suggest other people that they should speak to, and I think it was something that I didn't do that I wish I did do, just kind of like try to connect to people, but you feel a bit like nervous about doing it. But now if someone messages me, then I'm like really happy to chat to them. And I think it's that kind of thing that you don't necessarily know about, but that's why also events like this are so good, where you can hear people talk and then maybe you can reach out to them after. And like from my own perspective, and I'm sure everyone else is here, like we're so happy to share things. But when I started, I didn't know that. I didn't know people would be like happy to like, you know, help me out. So yeah, and then recently I got a grant and things like that. So recently I now get more help. But when I started, for like the first 3 years, it's basically just like self-learning and self-figuring it all out.
Sorry, my mic died. Jenya, so what about you? What kind of help have you received along the way? I know that also you have a previous life as a journalist, which also is another I experienced it myself as a quite toxic environment. You had a different experience as well, but like, yeah, what kind of insights do you have?
Actually, I'm very spoiled. I always worked for really nice organisations.
Amazing.
I was at the BBC for many years, and although I was the youngest news and current affairs editor in the newsroom and managing mostly men, because it's politics, I thought, I don't know, it was nice. I felt like it was a really good environment, and then I was at change.org, and that was super lovely culture as well. So male-dominated, but I actually never felt that there was any sort of discrimination but help along the way.
Why? Yeah. Why do you think is that? Like, what created the environment that was so...
At change.org, it was very deliberate. It came from the leadership, which I became part of, the culture, very, very consciously there was a lot of us women in the top. At the BBC.
Go BBC. BBC. I always listen to the BBC at home in the US.
So I felt supported. Again, lots of women at the top. Mm. Not at the very top, but lots of women. So the people above me were mostly women. Mm.
And what type of a team do you have?
Maternity leave.
Amazing.
Great maternity leave. We are an all female team.
Yeah, at Being London at the moment. So how many of you?
We are four key members of staff and two interns at the moment. And Roberto is here. But in terms of this support that we got, I'm notoriously rubbish at asking for help. So what you were talking about, I'm really bad at asking for help, and this is something I'm trying to learn. But we have had some support. We actually had some amazing support from the Trampery before this campus was set up. They ran while I still had a full-time job as director of comms at change.org, but I had this idea of turning waste into products. And can you make a product entirely from materials that are already out there in the system and make it look good, make it functional, make it transparent, and all of those things that we are now. It was just an idea, and the Trampery were running a sustainable fashion accelerator.
When was that?
That was 3 years ago, maybe four, I don't know, three
so
and
So you
five.
Accelerated pretty quickly.
Not really, but like, we're going so slowly. But they were incredible, and the biggest help from that accelerator was actually putting us all in one room. Mm. We were primarily female founders, and Reritan, who are not in the room, but they're part of the campus. That's where we met. Sabina, who's not in the room, but is part of the campus. That's where we all met. And I think us supporting each other was almost as big as the rest of the support that the accelerator provided. It was quite light touch. We were the initial kind of the initial cohort that were just testing. We were the guinea pigs of that program. So that was incredible. Another thing I would recommend to any female founders who are looking for funding is a duo called Hotbed. If anyone's looking for investment, we're part of an accelerator at the moment, and there are two women who run this. So unlike any other accelerator that is all kind of investment readiness thing, they are usually run by men.
Mm.
And I find that despite, we work with Netflix, we work with Formula One, I'm chicken and out every time I have to go and actually present us. And it's a confidence thing. It's about us, like women, being conditioned not to really go and boast about things. And I think there's something about having female mentors or female guides. I mean, they hold your hand, like they're two girls and they're younger than me, which is not difficult to do, but they're like incredible, and they hold your hand and they help you navigate this world of very, I mean, it's like investment bankers we're talking about, or angel investors. It's very logical, and I find it personally quite a harsh environment to navigate. So, yeah, so that sort of help was also really amazing. And I think for us, I mean, press have been really, really kind to us, so that's been a big support. And our customers, most important, like, they're just above everything. I can see some in the room. but just the support that we've been getting from the community. We're also partially owned by our customers.
Amazing. So like an equity.
We did an equity crowdfunding 3 years ago.
Fantastic.
At the very beginning. We invited our customers to become co-owners of the company, so we're actually owned by women, primarily women.
A big applause for that. That is literally like looking to the future. I think we should do like another panel discussion solely just focusing on the equity ownership and how to dismantle the current system. But that's for another talk. So we're talking about sustainability and equality, but I also would like to ask you, how do you define success? What does it look like to you? Perhaps we could start from Chantal at the end.
Easy.
Well, if you have nothing to say, you'll pass off the mic, obviously.
So I'm just starting off, but I guess to define success is just to see like people really embracing your brand culture, really. I really envision my brand to be growing a community of creatives together, and just seeing the changes in consumer behaviors and stuff. I just want to see the action, the results of what I want to change. I know we can think about money as well, but I just want to see the changes in the community, really.
Amazing, great, Gracian.
I think mine's a bit more esoteric and less personal. I would think success would look like, I would say, a complete reinvention of how we do things, you know, from every model that we possibly can think of. And it being in line with our planetary boundaries. And if we're able to achieve all of these things that we talk about, circularity, sustainability, and be prosperous at the same time, right? Changing the prosperity model, that would be successful, and I'd be a happy girl.
Prosperous and happy. I'm going to join your team.
That's a really big question. I think success probably is to still be standing. I think it's, yeah, sometimes I even just a few of the things that you mentioned before, in terms of having, whether it's comments that you get from people or having an impact on someone, whether it's big or small, and actually being in a position where you're, whether it's a legacy or your project is kind of still going, yeah, to me, that's a success if you kind of created something that lives on in whatever form. In our case, it's probably just getting this journal done and writing it and getting it out there, but then seeing the impact of it, or kind of seeing the impact that it has, whether or not we continue doing our work for another 10 years or whether it goes on for 100 years before I'm, way after me. But it's about having that impact. And there's an interesting quote, I think it was Oprah and Maya Angelou were having a conversation or something, and one of them said to the other, you'll never actually really know the impact of your legacy, because it could be a word that you said to someone or a post that you put out on Instagram, and you never actually know how that impacted people. It might have impacted one person, over your life it may have impacted 1,000 people, but you'd never be able to have a tangible figure for your legacy. So it's just having that constant impact, really.
Love it. Lydia?
I think mine's slightly different. My version of success is probably quite personal. So like my brand mission is like creatively tackle textile waste. So that's like a big goal. But my measure of success is personal success, slightly different to yours. And it's just like having consistent growth, like in two senses, like growth in terms of like my brand opportunities and the amount of people that I reach, but then also from the personal point of view, growth like doing things that I used to be, like I do a lot of workshops, and when I first started doing them, I was so nervous, I hated doing them, but I just had to push through that, and I hated it. And I felt, I was like, why am I doing this? I can't sleep for 3 days before a workshop. But just pushing through that, and then that growth, then now I can do workshops quite confidently, and I don't mind doing them, I really enjoy them. So I think my success is actually looking back at things that I used to hate doing that now I can do. So I think that's like for other people that are like founding a brand or like trying to do their own thing, like it is horrible, like you get so nervous about things, but you'll be fine. You just have to push through that and then you'll be okay down the line. So that's my measure of success, is now being comfortable doing things that I used to hate doing.
Wow, what a learning curve.
Good one. For me, it's twofold. One is very kind of immediate and very simple. It's convincing enough people to swap their next handbag purchase, quite niche, I know, with something that is made from waste. Something that doesn't need to take any resources, natural resources that are virgin and non-renewable. So this is like a small immediate goal. But bigger picture, ideally, we don't have the word waste anymore. Like this would be, and then we can happily close shop and close the company. This would be, I think, the ideal outcome of this
happily.
Thinking. We're probably very poor, and but I think as long as there is waste, I think there is a need in people like us picking it up and turning it into something that can be used over and over again. But the kind of the big dream is that there is no waste and we can just cease to exist and go and enjoy another glass of wine.
Beautiful. So before the other glass of wine, I want to open the floor for questions. So if there are any burning questions in the room, this is your time to ask them from our wonderful panelists of tonight. Any raising hands? Yeah,
that's great.
Yes.
Do I need a mic? Or
please speak on the mic.
I was wondering, how do you guys see, obviously, like in the current economy, so much is driven by competition between brands, and I really love the idea of having a more collaborative view on everything. But presumably, at some point, even if all the brands out there were kind of circular economy and all with a mindset of collaborating with as many people as they could, there's going to be like a big element of competition there eventually, right? And that's where the kind of, I guess, the focus on the cost per clicks, etc., becomes more important. So I'm just kind of wondering, it's kind of a broad question, but how do you guys see that kind of landscape play out in terms of competition, which is more like a masculine associated word within like the sustainable economy?
Fundamentally, the thing with competition is that each stakeholder...
Please speak on the mic.
Oh, sorry. Each stakeholder is trying to fight for their plot of land, right? And so you would think that in a collaborative approach, so long as each stakeholder feels that they are sufficiently, satisfied with what they're getting, so they're getting X amount of customers or they're getting X amount of business, that that's fitting the kind of desires of what they want, right? So instead of, I don't know if I understand the question actually, because it's a competition in like a circular approach, right? Like in circularity, we need collaboration. That's basically what you're saying. And then how does that work if each person is fighting for the same resources?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
Okay. The same customers.
Well, the same, exactly.
But the same revenue.
Everyone will be fighting for
there's only an issue with that if the goal is infinite growth, isn't there? Like, if you let the infinite growth idea go, and this is what all the VCs and all the kind of, again, the capitalist system is pushing everyone for, if you let go of that idea, then there is enough for everyone.
Yeah.
Then it's easier to think about. Sorry, I can't pass this on. But
No, I think it's literally what you were saying, because I was thinking that it's like the monopoly mindset. So it is at the moment the way business works, even if we look at the way that London works in terms of who owns what, it's such a monopoly approach. And then you kind of really look at things and you realise, actually, not a lot of people really own the plot of land. It's, you know, certain organisations or certain developers own certain things because it's the monopoly mindset. But for example, a lot of the stuff that we're doing with farming, that what we're realising really it's about, there's kind of growing for profit. And I know there's quite a few people that speak out about things like, should there be billionaires really? Like, if you're making billions of pounds of profit, why, you've already covered your cost, what's that extra for? And when we look at farming, for example, it's like, you know, there's hundreds of farmers across the world, it's not just thousands across the world, but even in the UK, there's like loads of farmers, and if they can service their kind of local communities and make enough to sustain themselves, so it really is kind of this weird local global approach almost. Like you were saying, there's that the greed thing, isn't it? It's wanting everything as opposed to kind of accepting that actually we can work smaller, more people can work smaller, as opposed to one person or five people owning everything, which is obviously the traditional kind of corporate, or the way things are at the moment. Change that.
I mean, you could argue that we're currently not living in a competitive model, right? Like, what is it called? Like the corporatocracy, where basically the corporate, you know, 1% are all living in like a socialist system, and the rest of us are competing for the very small resources that we have at the bottom. But the corporations are actually on a socialized tax breaks, all these things. So really, competition at that monopolizing level doesn't actually really exist for them.
Yeah, what a wonderful, thought-provoking question. Thank you for that. I think we've got time for one more, unless Lydia has something burning to say on that.
I was just going to say on that.
Yeah, sure.
I think really large brands and corporations, they aren't really able to be fully sustainable unless they kind of go back to square one, which they're probably not going to do. So actually the future is collaboration. And I think it's going to take so long for these huge brands to actually be sustainable that actually collaboration is the future still. So I think we're not even at the point where collaboration is not going to be a thing. I think that's a very big next step. Brands that can't really access sustainability to be sustainable is by collaborating with and employing and paying transparent, ethical, sustainable brands.
It's a very good question.
Lots to think about. Well, we can continue the discussions, obviously, after the panel. But there was another question. Can we please pass the level?
To who?
Who
had the question?
Did you have the question?
Colin and Matt.
You had a
question, so
we're all up here.
But I have so many, I don't know which one to choose.
Just pick up one.
Okay, so I'm coming
from... Can you
from
please speak on the mic?
Okay. I'm coming from the US and I'd like to launch my brand here. I've started the company already, but one of the draws for me coming to the UK was that you guys have maybe hundreds of sustainability organizations that are meant to support sustainable designers, but I'm not finding any place that has some sort of an incubator status where you would have resources, like where can you get, you know, sewing and pattern making and production facilities that would be at the right scale for a sustainable business. And so I'm just wondering if there is something that I don't know about.
Yes. I think actually this space is about to become one of those, right?
Yeah, this space, I can answer that. Mills Fabrica mm-hmm. in King's Cross is an incubator that has sewing and like garment making facilities. Maker University, or like Maker
yeah,
University,
Maker
yeah, is also another incubator space for, that's in
Somerset House.
Yeah, Maker University, Mills Fabrica.
The trampery, because they've got popular works.
Yeah. The trampery.
Because one of the issues is for sustainable brands, and especially independent new brands, is that you know, if they're actually trying to be sustainable to some part, you know, to some significant part that sets them apart, then they're not ever going to be desirable to any kind of equity investment. And to be 100% honest, if I'm not creating the next H&M and have, you know, gazillions of dollars that I can make, then I'm going to always, like over the lifetime of the brand, will make much less than one of those organizations, you know, companies. So there should be a different system of funding for designers that are sustainable.
Yeah.
Because they're never going to be attractive to equity investment, and because they're not going to make as much money over the lifetime of the brand, they shouldn't have to give up equity. You know what I'm saying? It should be like a government funding or special industry funds and so on.
There are special industry funds.
There are?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm happy to talk to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, one more comment from Chantal.
I just wanted to add, I'm a start myself and finding all the information and places to use in London or elsewhere. There's a platform called Common Objective.
Mm-hmm.
You can find local and international like manufacturers, production, like all, everything you will need, even suppliers. And that really helped me a lot with finding the people I'm working with. So that's a platform to even put your own brand in so that you can get customers as well. I completely forgot what the other one was. In terms of like funding and everything, because sustainability also comes in line with social impact causes as well, there are loads, I have seen grants. I wouldn't say they're like the biggest of grants, but grants that do support causes like that. Because I do social impact and like environmental kind of justice in terms of my brand, I try to make sure that I'm finding those specific grants that want to support that cause, and they also help in the long run as well. I've found like maybe three so far, and thankfully also, yeah, I got a grant locally through Echo. Echo is like a platform economy of hours where you share skills with each other. So if you do need that extra help with like trying to find out how to market your brand or like how to do branding or anything, you just need to find the right people. Echo is like a platform where you share the skills rather than like paying for someone's service at the forefront. You try and like get that little bit of advice. And yeah, I joined their program and I managed to win a grant last year, and that really helped me. Even if it was the smallest seed grant, it just helped me be in the position that I'm in now.
It looks like I killed another mic.
That's what we do tonight. Thank you so much for our wonderful panelists, for your wisdom, for your beautiful insights, and for sharing your knowledge so generously with us. So a huge round of applause. With all of them and with all of us, do network, grab another drink, stay here for a little bit longer, get your copy of the Browsing magazine. This panel discussion will also be on the Girl Get a Real Job podcast, normalizing conversations around financial literacy and being a creative entrepreneur. Thank you so much for all of you.
If you liked this episode, please review it or share it with a friend. To continue the conversation, please find us on social media at Women of the Week and Girl Get a Real Job. See you there.